This is Elodie Reed, digital producer for Vermont Public Radio. This podcast has been edited for brevity and clarity.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Last night, President Biden unveiled a nearly $2 trillion plan to primarily help workers, families, students, and children. And this is on top of a $2 trillion infrastructure proposal he released earlier this month. These plans represent some of the biggest increases in federal spending programs since the New Deal in the 1930s. Is this the approach that Congress should be taking? That's one of the questions we have for our guest today, Congressman Peter Welch. Congressman, welcome back to Vermont Edition.
Thank you.
We really appreciate you taking the time to be available to talk to us about a lot of these important issues. And listeners, you can join the conversation here at Vermont Edition. You can give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. What are your thoughts about the spending initiatives that have been unveiled by President Biden? What do you think about the way he wants to fund these proposals? Congressman Welch, let's put these spending plans in some perspective. The budget for the entire federal government is roughly $4.5 trillion. That's everything. That's the entire budget. With these two initiatives, President Biden is proposing to spend just over $4 trillion. Are you convinced that it's a good idea to pump this much money into these initiatives at this time?
I am. And the question is, first of all, what are we spending it on? Is there a need that has to be addressed? And number two, how will we pay for it? So the question for me is why we have had such a lack of investment, such a deficit of investment on things that are really important to our families. And that's, of course, the American Families Act, and what's really important to the long-term well-being of our infrastructure, our roads, our bridges, our broadband, and that's $2.1 trillion. And this is over a period of more than a decade. So the neglect that we have had of federal investment in the infrastructure that our families need, and that we need here desperately in Vermont, and the infrastructure we need in this state and in this country for things like broadband, roads, and bridges, repairing our schools, that I think needs to be done, and it's been ignored for far too long.
So do you see these as part of a pandemic recovery act for this country, or do they represent more of a pent-up demand for some of the key priorities of congressional Democrats?
No, this is post-COVID. We've got to get through COVID, and let's think about the progress we've made. It was a little over a year ago when I was flying back from Washington. I was literally the only person on the plane. The governor declared the state of emergency. All of us were incredibly anxious about the health and well-being of our families or the businesses that we were running or the jobs that we had. And we've made great progress on that with good leadership from President Biden getting the vaccines out, with good leadership here in the state of Vermont with Governor Scott. But what has been neglected in this country, let's talk about Vermont. One of the challenges we have with the workforce and with young people wanting to stay in Vermont, can they get access to affordable education? And under this plan, there'll be 2 years of free community college, and this will help our state colleges. We need to have early childhood education. You know, in Vermont, the Business Roundtable, which has done a great job over the years, it's a business group. They have been the main advocates for early childhood education. And in this American Families Plan, we'd have 2 years at the front end of education for all of our kids. The child care tax credit, that's a check of $300 a month for folks who have children under the age of five, makes a real difference in the capacity of parents to be back at work. And we, you know, two-thirds of the women who are have children, yet very, very young children, are not in the workforce, and they aren't there because there's no affordable child care. So these things are what a modern society needs. You have to have confidence that your children are going to be getting educated earlier, that you have access to child care that is secure and beneficial for the kids. Family leave. And these are all debated in Montpelier, but you really can't get there without a significant federal role. And if we do these things, there are things that are going to help us, I think, with the demographics in this state and with the challenges that people have who want to work but have obligations at home with young children or have a sick child or a sick partner. So, yes, I think these things are very good. And they're good, by the way, whether you voted for Trump or you voted for Biden. Our society needs these.
So do you think some of these issues that you've mentioned, child care, free college tuition, or workforce training, that these issues have been highlighted because of the pandemic and it showed the need to really make these investments?
I do. The pandemic really demonstrated the threadbare social insurance programs that we lack in this country. And, you know, when you think, Bob, about the debates we're having in Montpelier oftentimes about paid family leave or about early childhood education, you know, generally people are in favor of those because it doesn't matter whether you're conservative or liberal. And as I said, Trump or Biden voter, if you've got kids at home and you can't go to work, that's a tough choice. But if you don't have affordable child care, you don't have many options. And the problem when a state is trying to face this is that there's not a capacity to pay for it. And if we try to just impose the full burden on an employer, it's going to be really, really crushing on our employers. So there has to be a federal role in acknowledging that we've got to have affordable health care, child care that works, that is affordable, that kids who want to get ahead need more than the K-12 education that has been the hallmark of our society. Those extra 2 years are really going to make a difference. So it's long overdue, and the debates have been stirring about this right in Vermont in the legislature and in other legislatures all across the country. So this is a welcome dramatic change in emphasis. Let's do economic assistance in policies that are going to help from the bottom up, not just the top down.
Let's talk to Bart, who's calling from Hinsdale, New Hampshire. Hey, Bart, welcome to the program.
Morning. Actually, I'm over here in Brattleboro.
Oh, well, that's good.
However,
to know. What?
I want to make a statement and then a question to Congressman Welch. Isn't Vermont losing young people? And then second, what kind of jobs can we expect in Vermont from this program?
Well, number one, we've got a real demographic challenge here in Vermont. So you're right about that. Number two, if we're going to get money that will come to help us, we can get jobs and a lot of jobs in construction. Just for instance, we would be rehabilitating our schools. And local property taxpayers can't foot that bill on their own. But our schools, in many cases, are falling apart. I was up in Gilman, Vermont, a tiny little town with great people, and they've got a school that they don't know that they'll be able to keep open. So construction jobs there, roads and bridges, child care jobs, where we try to pay better wages and living wages to folks who are entrusted with the responsibility of taking care of our kids while parents are at work, jobs in building, in retrofitting homes. I mean, what this jobs program is not make work. It's doing the work that needs to be done. One of the big challenges we have in Vermont is the incredibly high cost of housing that's been exacerbated during the COVID outbreak, with a lot of folks who do have a lot of money coming up here and buying some of our depleted housing stock. Well, under the jobs plan, we're going to be trying to build over 2 million affordable housing units for low and middle income people. So the array of jobs that is out there, if we take on the challenge of everything from getting lead pipes replaced, retrofitting homes and commercial buildings, fixing up our schools, providing daycare, buttressing our community colleges where there'll be professor and teacher jobs. All of these are things that need to be done. That's what I think has got that's why I think the president has so much support for this proposal. It's not a red state, blue state type of deal. It's about acknowledging the challenges we face, facing those challenges, and then putting the weight of the federal government behind it.
Bart, thanks for your phone call. Congressman, I wonder how much bipartisan support there really is for this proposal. South Carolina Senator Tim Scott spoke yesterday after President Biden's speech. He said that the American Families Plan was, quote, big government waste. He complained that the president has rejected compromising with the Republicans, who he says have made it clear they have absolutely no intention of supporting government on the scale that he's called for. So is there really bipartisan support on this?
In Congress, there won't be. I mean, Tim Scott, it speaks for Mitch McConnell, speaks for Kevin McCarthy. But let's try to peel away the rhetoric here. This big government, what we're talking about is child care. We're talking about retrofitting homes. We're talking about removing lead pipes and putting in safe pipes. We're talking about broadband. So when you go down the list, and I just mentioned four, I can talk to Republicans, independents, and Democrats here, and they say, yes, we want broadband. Yes, that would be great if I had secure and affordable child care for my kids so I could go to work. So when Tim talks that way, it's really rhetoric that gets in the way of having an assessment. Wait a minute, does our community need a retrofitted school? Do we want to tighten up our homes? Do we want to have jobs in construction by building the affordable housing that our community needs? So I see that as sort of general Washington speak, where you trash talk what the other side is doing. And there, unfortunately, in D.C. right now, we don't have a bipartisan leadership where Mitch McConnell is going to, in a genuine way, sit down with the person who's been elected president of the United States. Keep in mind that McConnell didn't even acknowledge that Biden was the president until January 6th. So that's a problem, and it's a problem for the country. But what you do see is that there's significant bipartisan support for many of the proposals that are being offered in the, by polling shows. People want infrastructure. They want better schools. They want more affordable child care. So as long as what we're doing, we can defend as beneficial to you, whether you voted for Trump or you voted for Biden, then I think we can get the bipartisan support we need ultimately to get this across the finish line, even if it's Washington politics as usual.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Judy, who is calling from Cabot. Hi, Judy. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Bob. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. What's on your mind today?
Well, I would like to applaud the support, Peter, that you are giving to child care, that you are voicing the needs of so many families and parents in the state of Vermont. I have been an educator for over 53 years. I started as an administrator in the Boston Public Schools, a principal, in Roxbury during desegregation. I have never seen more struggle, not even then, that I see today. I have child care in St. Johnsbury. I am a five-star center. We have an incredibly excellent preschool program, and yet we can and we hardly survive. I take loans from myself, from my retirement, constantly to support my center. We probably lose over $20,000 every year because even though 87% of my families are subsidized, not all at 100%, but many, they still cannot pay the difference of what my posted tuition is because I'm a five-star center. I have to charge that or the state wouldn't pay that to me. Parents are struggling. They can't afford to pay the difference. We have to have a real shakeup so that every family and every child in Vermont is able to claim their place in affordable, high-quality, accessible child care. So many child care centers have closed. closed down.
Well, thank you. Yeah, no, thank you so much for the work you're doing. And I know what you said is really the reality for many families and, of course, for child care centers like you run. So thank you very much.
And Congressman Welch, when you look at the child care provisions of this bill, you're looking at several different aspects, aren't you? Aren't you looking at more money for subsidies so that child care can be more affordable for more families? And you're also putting money into the training of child care workers so that those workers can have higher salaries?
That's correct. As the caller just pointed out, you have to have good child care workers, and those are incredibly important jobs. But they're underpaid, so we've got to help there. The child care tax credit is going to boost the incomes for parents. You know, if you have a child under five, the child care tax credit is $300 a month. And the economists say that's going to reduce childhood poverty by over 50%. And if we, in only 13% of our kids here in Vermont who are in poverty got preschool. And by having access to that preschool, that's going to help give those low-income children an opportunity to have a life of opportunity instead of a life of poverty. So these are things that need to be done. And when we have been imposing the full burden on the state, and where then the very tough questions that Montpelier and the governor have to address, how do we pay for it? And it then imposes an additional burden if you want to raise taxes from employers or Vermonters, and we have limited resources. The reality is the federal government's got to play a big role here. And by the way, I want to talk about how we're going to pay for this, because we've had policies in Washington that essentially had a trickle-down theory behind it. If you lower taxes for wealthy, very profitable corporations and very wealthy people, somehow that's going to trickle down to benefit everybody. But we've had a record now of 30 years of that. Where's the broadband? Where's the child care? Where's the rehabilitated schools? Where's the affordable housing? It doesn't exist. And what the Biden administration is finally doing is acknowledging that and facing it directly. And on the tax, we've got to pay for things. All right. I agree with that. But the approach here, the Biden administration said, look, we're not going to raise taxes on anybody whose income is below $400,000. And that's pretty much every Vermonter. And it's going to address it by, among other things, raising the corporate tax. You know, we have corporations like Nike. If you spend $130 on a pair of sneakers, you've spent more than Nike pays in taxes, even though it's a multi-billion dollar, extraordinarily profitable company. You know, I think Vermonters and Americans are outraged at that. That's just not right. And one of the things that the Biden plan does is going to put $80 billion into the IRS, which has been habitually underfunded, so they can go after tax cheats, corporations and individuals who are hiding a lot of money using offshoring and other devices, and that can raise about $700 billion. So there are things that we need to do that really are about ending the dilapidated tax system we have and the unfair tax system we have. So we can do that without imposing additional burdens on working families and use that money to help families that are struggling with the day-to-day challenge of getting to work, getting their kids to school, trying to figure out how to pay the rent, looking for a house when the price is going up and beyond their means, sending their kids to schools that are falling apart because the local property taxpayers can't quite afford to do the improvements that we know need to be done. So this is overdue. And I want to keep coming back to the really essential point here. All of this requires people to do the jobs to get this done, and that means more jobs, and better incomes for people.
Congressman, just one final thought on the education package. You talked about the pre-K money and also 2 years of community college. Is this sort of a policy recognition that K through 12 is just not enough anymore, that folks need to have more education than that?
It is. It's a full-on embrace of that. Again, I mentioned our Vermont Business Roundtable here in Vermont for years advocating for early childhood education. those kids need that early start to have a shot in this modern world. And then graduating from high school is not enough. So 2 years is a minimum additional education that we need to make available to our kids. So, yes, and President Biden was very, very explicit that he believes we need 2 more years on the front end and 2 more years on the back end than our traditional K through 12.
There may be some people listening who are wondering, what does this bill do, if anything, or maybe it's separate legislation, for folks who have accumulated just a mountain of student debt? You know, there are folks who are $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 more in debt because of their college loans. And these are certainly loans that affect financial decisions that they make throughout their careers. Does this bill address that, or is that separate legislation?
It's an urgent problem, and we're going to have to deal with that separately. I mean, that is exactly right, Bob. The student debt that many people have is just crushing, and they can't get a start. They can't put a down payment on a condominium, or let alone a house. They can't really get started. And the interest rates that people are paying are outrageous, including parents who borrow money to benefit their children. So a lot of us are really advocating that there be some loan forgiveness, that there be an adjustment in interest rates so that the interest rates, Senator Warren and I have a bill that says that the interest rates on loans would come down to what the government pays, which is, you know, in the range of 1 to 2% as opposed to 6 to 7%. So that continues to be an enormous challenge for young people. It makes a difference on the ability of people come to Vermont.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Jenny, who's calling from Norwich. Hi, Jenny. Welcome to the program. Well, we have some technical problems, but we will try to solve them in the coming moments. Once again, our guest today is Congressman Peter Welch. We've been talking about President Biden's initiatives. I wanted to go back to you talking about how this is going to be paid for. I think you said there's $80 billion for the IRS to go after tax cheats. You know, we've heard for years, if not decades, that there's all this money out there. If we just had stricter enforcement of the Internal Revenue Code, is this real money or is it kind of phantom money?
No, it's real money. I mean, the agenda in Washington under a couple of previous administrations was to starve the IRS. That was certainly the case in the Trump administration. A, they lowered taxes, $2.3 trillion, as you know. That went to corporations, lowering the effective tax rate or the rate from 35 to 21. It also lowered taxes for the top 1%. There was really no relief for middle-income and low-income families. Also, they starved the budget, the enforcement budget for the IRS, and there's very little prospect of a very, very wealthy person or multinational corporation having a big deal audit that would uncover abuse. So we put the money back in for enforcement, and the studies indicate that $80 billion over 10 years would produce about $700 billion, and I think encourage people to be more compliant. So it's real. The second thing is there is in our tax code encouraging policies that have corporations outsource or do job inversions by setting up tax haven entities in Ireland, let's say, or Bermuda, or the Grand Caymans. And that is just a job killer for jobs being created here in the United States. So these are things that have been overlooked and shouldn't be any longer. And obviously we should make the folks who owe money should pay it before we ask people who are paying money to pay more.
Congressman, we got this email from Caleb in Barnard. How can we change the popular attitude toward taxes in order to inspire the top earners and corporations to see their taxes as a reinvestment in the systems and that society has brought them such success? Times have changed with technology, and now the government's institutional infrastructure makes it well-placed to be an effective coordinator and facilitator for states who implement so much of public policy. What about that idea of changing the public attitude?
Well, I think he's got a really, really good point because, you know, in this country, we traditionally have had high tax compliance compared to many other countries. That's definitely been true for people on payrolls because they have deductions. They have the tax taken out of their paycheck each month. It used to be the case for higher income folks as well, and that's declined. But I think a lot of the heart of that question goes to how do we restore faith in government? And I think there's two things. I think number one, each of us as a citizen has to go back to the basics that I think we embrace here in Vermont, and that's mutual respect. You know, we disagree with somebody, but we do it respectfully. We ask them, we listen, and try to work out different points of view. The second is we've got to be effective. We've got to have government work in a way where people can see the benefit. And by the way, Bob, I want to make a point about this, because a lot of times in the reaction to the spending here, the rescue package and the Families Act, people will focus on the top line number and say that's, quote, big government. None of this is going to work. None of this is going to work unless there is really effective engagement at the community level by our select boards who are going to be making decisions about some money that comes their way, about our school boards where they're going to have to figure out how to use this money to improve their schools, by our small businesses that are going to get some help to help their employees with affordable health care and perhaps with family leave. In early childhood education. So the implementation of this ambitious bottom-up approach is really going to depend on the ingenuity, the competence, and the commitment of people in each of our communities. So I see this as something that can be empowering for the revitalization of our local communities where the ultimate decisions and executions have to be made.
I wanted to ask you whether or not you think the American Families Plan and the infrastructure bill actually highlight the difficulties that the Democrats are having in passing legislation in the Congress. You've got a small majority in the U.S. House. The Senate, we know, is tied 50-50. That means that several moderate Democratic senators have a lot of influence if a bill is going to pass. And right now we hear them talking about scaling back some of these bills. What do you make of that situation?
Well, the dilemma we have in Washington is best symbolized by what Mitch McConnell said after Barack Obama was elected his first time. McConnell was the leader of the Republicans then. Obama had just been elected, and the press asked Senator McConnell, how do you define your job? And even though he was just elected and Obama was just elected, McConnell said, my job is to make certain the president is a one-term president. That's terrible, because the job all of us have, whether we're elected as a Republican or Democrat, once the election is over, our job is to do things that help the people we represent. Yet,
but Congressman, I'm thinking more about West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin more than Mitch McConnell.
Okay. He definitely has an immense amount of sway in a 50-50 Senate. Anybody on the Democratic side is going to have an opportunity to be the hero or the villain. Manchin did something impossible, by the way. You know, he won as a Democrat in West Virginia, which President Trump won by 30 points. So we've got to acknowledge that he did something that it's hard to imagine anybody else there doing. But at the end of the day, I think Joe Manchin is somebody who really cares about the well-being of a lot of those coal miners that he represents. And I think on these issues that are going to be helpful to those families, and I think these issues we've been talking about with child care and health care and rebuilding schools and roads and bridges, I think at the end of the day, Manchin's going to be there. Whether the proposal as presented by President Biden in the exact number is going to be where we end up, I don't know. But I do believe that Joe Manchin and the Democrats will stick together on this.
Congressman, at the end of February, on party lines, the House passed the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act. The bill addresses police misconduct, use of excessive force by law enforcement, also calls for data collection to reform police policies. Now, many Republicans who voted against this bill either argued that this is more appropriately a state issue or the bill goes too far in restricting the ability of the police to defend themselves in dangerous situations. What do you say to those members?
Well, we need reform in policing. And, of course, George Floyd, the outcome of that trial, it's the first time an officer was convicted of murder in Minnesota. And we all saw and watched with horror that officer with his knee on the neck of George Floyd for 9 minutes. And every day since that verdict, about three individuals have died in confrontations with police. So there's no question that we've got to step back and reform policing procedures. And it is, I think, important to have national legislation that bans things like chokeholds. And by the way, the George Floyd Policing Act provides money to local communities to do police reform. It doesn't take money away. But you're going to have to have, we're going to have two things. One, the national legislation, as is in the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act. But where it really is going to matter is at the local community level, where citizens have to have confidence that the police have their back. And we've developed practices that need to be addressed, and the George Floyd Policing Act gets us moving on that. And by the way, there's a lot of police departments, including our Vermont State Police, that are fully engaged in doing things that will make them have more trust within our communities.
I wanted to ask you, do you think the cases of misconduct that we've seen in the last few months and years are exceptions to the rule, just a few bad apples trying to operate outside the law? Or are these cases a strong indication that the problem is a lot more serious than that, and that in many cases we're looking at systematic racism in a number of police departments?
Well, I definitely think there has been systematic racism in many of the police departments around the country. I mean, the record in Chicago was really, really terrible. And there's many other places where there's a culture of impunity that has to be addressed. So I think we're coming to terms with that. I mean, all of us saw the Officer Chauvin with his knee on George Floyd's neck for 9 minutes. And what was so, so shocking, everything was shocking. But Officer Chauvin had his hands in his pocket. He looked bored and unconcerned. He didn't mind that everybody was videotaping him and they were watching. And it really reflected his sense that what he was doing was fine. He was going to get away with it. So that can't happen in a place where there's a different culture of respect and restraint. So, no, I think that these policing cases have really sort of pulled a scab off, where all of us have to address the reality that there has been systemic racism in this country.
Congressman, we did get an email about family farms. What do you think this Congress can do to help strengthen family farms?
You know, one of the best things we can do to strengthen family farms and agriculture is make them a big part of our climate action plan. I mean, agriculture can play a major role in helping us address climate change. And in fact, President Biden in his proposal last night mentioned that we can start, the more carbon capture that our farmers can provide, the sooner we're going to achieve our goal on climate initiatives. So that's number one. Number two, I think we have to renew our commitment to the importance of local agriculture. Local agriculture tends to be much more organic with less of the inputs that in traditional farming, the big commodity farming, is done. So, and all of us know that our farmers like our dairy farmers, our vegetable farmers here, they're really custodians of the landscape. So I believe and have been working on this with Patrick and Bernie for some time. We want to support farm to table. We want to support local organic agriculture. We want to have a dairy program that emphasizes smaller farms rather than these huge 10,000 head dairy farms. And what I was pleased at in the Biden presentation was his specific mention of the contribution agriculture can make to addressing climate change.
And do you think some kind of supply management system would be helpful?
I do. I've been a long advocate of supply management. I mean, our dairy farmers are just hammered because if the price of milk goes down and they have no control over it at all, then the only answer they have is to try to increase production to make up that difference. And as they increase production, then the price goes down even further. So having some balance between supply and demand is essential for sustainability. So we came very close to having a supply management passage some years ago, but it eluded us with the opposition of then-Speaker John Boehner. But we had for a while the New England Dairy Compact, where we were able in our region to have a version of supply management, and those were very, very good years for our dairy farmers. So, yes, I'm a strong proponent of supply management.
Let me ask you about Medicare and drug prices. What's the status of legislation that calls for Medicare to be able to negotiate drug prices with the pharmaceutical companies?
That's in the Energy and Commerce Committee, of which I'm a member. And, of course, I'm the sponsor of that bill, the Elijah Cummings prescription drug pricing bill. And this is absolutely essential. And first of all, by the way, then President Trump was a strong advocate of price negotiation because he knew that the prices that Americans were being charged were ripoff prices. We pay about three or four times the price for the same drug that people in France or Ireland or England pay. And it's just because the U.S. government won't protect consumers against the extraordinary pricing power of the pharmaceutical industry. And if we get price negotiation, the estimates are that it would save us about $500 billion without harming pharma. They just wouldn't get the ripoff prices. So my view is that that is essential. Now, number two, it's really important because the biggest challenge we have in our healthcare system right now is that it's just too expensive. And, you know, employers who provide healthcare for their employees are faced with 15, 20, 25% premium increases. And next thing you know, the workers don't get a raise if they want to keep their health care. Taxpayers are getting hammered, and individuals, if they pay the bill themselves, are getting hammered. So if we're going to maintain access to health care and expand it, we really have to address the cost of health care. And pharma expenses are the fastest rising component of health care. And it's not justified. It's just because the pricing power of pharma is so enormous. And the feeble response by the government has been so weak. So this is really important for us to do.
Congressman, there's some people who think that the current system actually shows why it's a good idea not to negotiate, and that's that millions and millions of doses of COVID-19 vaccine were available in this country in a very timely manner precisely because there were not lengthy negotiations over the cost of these vaccines, and that the countries that do have negotiating provisions got their vaccines at a later time. Is there anything to that argument?
No, there isn't, in my view. Number one, let's keep in mind that the development of these vaccines was a combination of enormous efforts by the federal government, enormous support for research by the federal government, in a partnership with some of our pharma companies that did a very good job on the development of this vaccine. It also was a result of the federal government putting money down to do advanced manufacturing. I mean, the federal government took the risk here so that these companies would have a capacity to produce these right away. So in a COVID situation, once in a century, the federal government did jump in the Trump administration on this question of supporting the research and that partnership. That's the one area where I think the Trump administration did a good job. But the and we weren't going to be quibbling about the price, but there definitely was negotiation so that it was within the range of reasonable.
Congressman, we did get this email in. This is from John, who wants to know, why is Louis DeJoy still the Postmaster General? And what have you done personally to see that he's removed from office? What's the holdup? I think John is expressing the frustration that many people have that the mail service these days doesn't seem to be what it used to be. I got to say, I sent a birthday card to a friend in Boston, and it took 5 weeks to get there.
Oh, that's terrible. But I agree with him. And we don't have authority over firing or hiring DeJoy. We just don't have it. But he has been proposing steps to address the financial situation that would curtail service and make a bad situation worse. So I'm in agreement with the critique of DeJoy, but not in a position as a member of Congress to fire him.
I mean, does Congress have any influence on making recommendations to replace the Postmaster General?
We don't. I mean, we can write letters and express our opposition to him, but it's ruled by a board of governors, and it would ultimately also obviously be up to President Biden as to what his recommendation is. So it's not us. The House of Representatives has not been involved in the decision about who is our Postmaster General. I mean, as you know, DeJoy was a Trump pick. Our big apprehension, and in addition to the service issues that the caller mentioned, were the delays that were engineered to occur right around the time of mail-in voting. So we had an enormous anxiety about what DeJoy would be doing to facilitate the delay of the mail-in votes. And, of course, he was a major contributor to the Trump campaign over the years, I think over $3 million. So that was quite alarming to many of us.
In all fairness to the post office, I wonder, do you think that some of these delays are legitimate because the post office has had to deal with the pandemic like everybody else? Or can they be traced more closely to the cuts that the Postmaster General has wanted to put into place?
It's a combination of things. Number one, the post office has lost a lot of revenue with the decline in first class mail and the use of email. So that's been a factor. Number two, there's been an imposition on the post office of pre-funding their liability for retirement and for health care. And that's billions of dollars, and it makes no sense. And many of us are trying to alleviate that burden from the post office so that their bottom line reflects the reality as opposed to this idiosyncratic requirement. So we have to maintain the post office to do what it's done since before this country was even founded. I mean, the post office goes back to before we had a country, and that's get the mail out. And those of us who are in rural areas are especially dependent on it. And, of course, our businesses are really dependent on it. So this has been an ongoing challenge, which we have made some progress on but are far from resolving.
Congressman, we just have a couple of minutes left, but what are the chances that Congress will decriminalize or even legalize cannabis in the coming months?
I don't see Congress doing that. What I see Congress doing is accepting the decisions that states have made, deferring to the decision Vermont makes or Montana or Colorado makes, and not having it be a federal crime. But I don't see that Congress would take up the cause of federally acting. It would continue to leave that for the states. You know, Bob,
I mean,
go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, go, please go ahead.
Well, you know, I know we're getting towards the end, and I just want to express my gratitude to Vermonters. I mean, we've been through an incredible year. I mentioned a year ago I got on that plane to come back at 10 o'clock at night, and I was the only person on the plane. When I arrived, literally the lights were off. The governor had just declared the state of emergency. People were terrified about, as I say, their health. Businesses were shutting down. Restaurants were closed. They had no idea where we were going to go, but Vermonters found a way and helped each other. And the outpouring of community activity to try to get us through this, helping a neighbor, helping a friend, sticking with your family, living with the social distancing, we've managed to do it. And there was a federal response, and initially it was bipartisan, and I was so grateful for that, with those PPP loans that helped our businesses keep the lights on and get through it. And we're now really, with the vaccines getting distributed across the country, with Vermonters getting vaccinated, we really have reason to be hopeful that we're going to be back to normal. And it's how, when we face a problem that was not our creation, the pandemic, everybody has to come together, the federal government, the state government, our local governments and schools, and our employers. And it's just so wonderful to have seen and continue to see Vermonters doing everything they can to pull together and help us get through this. So I think where we are now, where we're getting on top of the virus, and where we're starting to focus on the future, and we can have a sustainable recovery, I think that we've got a lot to be optimistic about.
Certainly much more than we were a year ago. There's no question about that. We're going to be following many of these issues very closely in the weeks ahead. Many thanks to Congressman Peter Welch for taking the time to talk with us today. Congressman, we really appreciate it.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Bob. I really appreciate it. And I appreciated the questions from Vermonters. And I really appreciate the opportunity to be available and answer the questions and hear from Vermonters. Thank you.